Reed Martin, what'd you think of the movie?
I'm convinced.
Howard Sherman, your review.
It proves once again that Roland Emmerich is the successor to Irwin Allen. He is, in fact, the master of disaster.
Matt Rippey, of course.
Awesome!
Ali Bostad, RSC office manager.
Favorite part, the trailer for Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Definitely.
And I would only say that as is only fitting from Roland Emmerich to echo Howard Sherman, Anonymous is synonymous with disaster.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's very special Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast number 256. We review Anonymous. Anonymous, the Sony Pictures film written by John Orloff, apparently, directed by Roland Emmerich, and starring Rhys Evans, Vanessa Redgrave, David Thewlis, and Rafe Spall, opened across the U.S. today, and we decided we had to be the very first paying customers to see it. Anonymous is, of course, the movie that tells the story of Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, who, according to the story of the film and the theories of so-called Oxfordians around the world, is the true author of the works of William Shakespeare. For this very special early podcast review, Reed Martin, Matt Rippey, Ali Bostad, and I were joined in the offices of the New Victory Theater in New York City, where we're in the second week of our three-week run of The Complete World of Sports Abridged, by noted arts pundit, theater blogger, and former podcaster himself, Howard Sherman, to review the film and discuss its merits.
I don't think it's possible to separate analyzing the movie as a movie and the story it's trying to tell, the theory it's trying to support. So, but if we can, let's see if we could just start talking about the movie as a movie. What did we think of it as a movie?
Well, that's the
Matt Rippey.
That's the only way to look at it as a movie. Because
okay.
if you're going to look at it as putting forth some, you know, theoretical idea or as an argument, well, then you're just buying into the propaganda machine, which is trying to sell tickets. It's a movie.
Right.
A movie equals entertainment. And that movie was entertaining. What's the matter with you? What's the matter with you people? I mean, come on. We've got ye olde costumes. We've got fantastic facial hair. We got great
explosions.
People talking with accents. I mean, what more could you want? We got royal intrigue, incest, political machinations, killing, shooting. Brilliant.
Brilliant. Oh.
Hunchbacks.
Hunchbacks.
There's even a hunchback.
Hunchback. A bit of saucy bawds on the bank side.
To me, there were two movies, and I liked one better than the other. I liked sort of the comedy of Edward de Vere, William Shakespeare. Ben Jonson,
yeah.
and Shakespeare and De Vere. That
Are you
was sort
sure
of
you
a comedy.
Saw both movies.
The other one was sort of this overdramatic soap opera about the machinations of the royal family and English and European politics.
Right.
And that I sort of dozed.
Okay.
I feel that it's one of the finest examples of nostril flaring acting that it has been my pleasure to see, and frankly, I wish it were a miniseries or a continuing network series. It would basically be, you know, Dynasty.
Right.
Except it would be Dynasty.
Right.
Yes, it would, wouldn't it? I thought the overacting to a person was just superb.
Right.
I really appreciate it for that.
Well, we should tell the plot of the movie. The plot of the movie.
Did you follow it?
Well, I was trying to follow it. The plot of the movie is that Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, was such a highly placed nobleman, but had a passion and a soul for art and poetry that he wants to write his plays, but he certainly absolutely can't do that because that would be ill-befitting a man of his position. So he finds this upstart crow, this actor, this really interesting, funny character named William Shakespeare, and he becomes the front.
I think he was my favorite kid. He was so vacuous. He was a perfect actor.
I thought it was perfect that in this movie, again, that's purporting to tell the story that Shakespeare's plays were written by Edward de Vere, that the movie came to life only when William Shakespeare, the character, appeared.
I loved his accent. He was sort of like, oh, mate, nice one. What? I'm being published in it. That's not like in a book.
Right.
Yeah. It was
It was great. I mean, that added a moment, it added several moments of levity, which I thought really almost saved the movie. Because I'm like you, I'm a big sucker for, and I will admit, I'm a sucker for Roland Emmerich movies. Roland Emmerich, the director of The Day After Tomorrow and Independence Day and other light classics. Which ones am I forgetting?
Godzilla,
yeah, right.
2012.
That's right.
And I believe 10,000 Years B.C.
Yes, you're right. I liked his earlier funnier movies, now that you rattle them all off.
I think we have to address some of the important questions raised by this film.
Yes.
First of all, I would like to know how it is that Derek Jacobi, at the very beginning of the film, walks into a theater on 44th Street and then is inside a theater in London. I think this is a central
right.
question for me.
That's right.
I think there are others that come up. I'd like to understand now whether the order of scenes, as we know Hamlet, are not as they were done, because according to this movie, Hamlet kills Polonius and then debates to be or not to be. I think, you know, these are some of the central questions that have to be answered.
Well, yeah, Howard, I'm glad we have you aboard, because you are certainly a scholar, a reduced scholar, but still.
Yes, I'm significantly diminished by this experience.
My biggest question is, who is responsible for Derek Jacobi's toupee? Oh, my God. Did you see that thing sitting on his head?
I wish they could. The same guy who did the beards for everybody else should have done Jacobi's toupee.
Here's my question.
Yeah.
This conspiracy among actors. We work in the theater. I don't know a single actor who couldn't shut up about something like this if they knew about it. You know, this conspiracy has been going on for hundreds of years. Actors would be blabbing 2 seconds, the second after they knew this.
Well, I guess the assumption in the movie is that all the actors think that Shakespeare actually wrote it. I guess, you know, but then there are all those jealous playwrights, Ben Jonson and Christopher Marlowe. I don't know enough about the historical accuracy, but that doesn't matter. The movie's a fantasy. The movie's a fantasy like Shakespeare in Love is a fantasy.
Yeah.
It is? Shakespeare in Love isn't true?
That was a documentary? I wasn't a documentary?
I'm just shocked. I thought that Gwyneth Paltrow was the first woman to appear on stage in Edwardian times.
Right.
Not Elizabethan times. I'm crushed.
This is a good point. Between those two films, I'm sorry, but I think I've slept through Shakespeare in Love. I mean, just Yawnsville. This movie, I don't know, you guys, maybe you needed to be on the front row with Allison and I.
You guys are sitting way up close.
Yeah, we were watching a different movie.
I think you were watching a different movie. Well, I love the CGI shots of London. I thought, as you say, the costumes and the beards, fantastic beard work.
Yeah.
I thought all that was great. But it began for me, both from a story standpoint and if it's genuinely purporting to try to prove that Edward de Vere wrote the plays of Shakespeare, I don't think it did the movie or that theory any favors, because it just seemed to it starts from a slightly, not totally implausible, I'm willing to buy the implausibility, but it just kept piling implausibility upon implausibility upon implausibility, and that kind of killed it for me. I was willing to buy it right up until sort of the end, where they say, oh, Edward de Vere wrote the plays. Oh, and he's also, spoiler alert, I won't say all the other implausibilities, but then they succeed to pile on more implausibilities right at the end that I just went, oh, really? Come on.
Well, what's amazing about the movie is like many works that try to do revisionist versions of Shakespeare, they try to show where the influences are. And so you see all of that, but the movie jumps the shark when it stops dealing with moments from Shakespeare plays that we're all supposed to recognize and starts dealing with the Greek plays. That's the moment when you say, I don't think Shakespeare wrote that one, but it's awfully familiar.
Uh-huh.
Does that mean... Oh.
But Shakespeare was inspired by the Greek, or whoever wrote the plays of Shakespeare was inspired by the Greeks as well, was he not?
Well, it's true, and in fact, it's often been said that Shakespeare ripped off a lot of other people's material. So in that sense, this is merely an homage.
Well, and I'm loving the controversy of this entire movie, because people are so up in arms. Matt Rippey did just a rant on Facebook recently about Stephen Marché's response to this movie in the New York Times. But I have no problem with the idea of this movie. I have no problem at all. I wanted it to be more compelling. But I mean, Shakespeare rewrote history. I mean, why is it
just saying?
Why
that.
Why is it not? Why are we not allowed to why aren't other people allowed to rewrite history in absence of incontrovertible proof?
Yeah, well, but if this was a documentary, then I think this conversation would make sense. But like I said to Stephen Marché on my Facebook page, is he said, you know, Shakespearean scholars, their livelihood is being threatened. But it's like, really?
Yeah,
sorry.
No.
So I said, you know, did Capricorn 1 end the space program?
No. It did! We're not going to the moon anymore!
No.
That's a terrible argument!
Did you pay attention to Capricorn 1?
Yeah.
That wasn't a space program! And they shut down the shuttles!
Did JFK bring down democracy? No!
Okay. It was Nixon!
And, you know, did Showgirls end Elizabeth Berkeley's career?
Pretty much.
Maybe
it's
another bad example.
I'm Michael Whitmore, director of the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This weekend and next, until November 6, 2011, you can see us performing The Complete World of Sports Abridged at the new Victory Theater in New York City. And next month, we'll premiere our latest stage show, The Ultimate Christmas Show Abridged, at the Merrimack Repertory Theater in Lowell, Massachusetts. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for The Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information.
But here's the most interesting revelation. There has been a copious amount of writing about this film in advance of it being seen in the papers, on the internet, on blogs. I certainly have done my part on Twitter to build skepticism regarding the film to the best of my ability. But so my favorite thing, I love reading credits. You never know it's going to be at the end of the credits. The Zucker brothers and Jim Abrahams did this to me. And so we've all been debating for weeks the quality of the film, the theories behind it, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if you stay to the very end, the film declares in small print, this is a work of fiction. So it's sort of like one of those, you know, it's a Twilight Zone episode, you know, right with Derek Jacobi as Rod Serling, which is, which is, you know, really amazing. And the twist at the end is they admit it's all fake.
Right. Yeah. Well, and they say at the beginning, Derek Jacobi said at the beginning, this is a, let me tell you another story. And he says, this is a story. And again, I'm with you. I don't have a problem with them. I just wish it were a better, slightly more plausible story.
Yeah, it's the smartest press PR assault for a film. Because look, it's got us talking about it. Yeah. It's got people tweeting, Facebooking very passionately about it. I mean, job done. Whoever came up with this idea to really focus on the historical record is genius.
And I remember when it was first sort of announced, people sort of tweeted and Facebooked us saying, oh, we've got to condemn this movie. We've got to get this movie banned. We've got to get it. And I was going, no. We celebrate all things Shakespeare. And any movie that gets a conversation going about Shakespeare, I think, is a good thing.
And so the movie aside, which it seems the consensus is, it was okay.
Not for Matt Rippey.
But in general, I mean, if you had to get a letter grade, I guess I'd give it about a B minus or a C plus.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does everybody else... I want to get back to what we think about the theory in itself, separate from the movie. But if we were going to give the grade a movie, the five of us, okay, say I'll give it a C plus.
Yeah, I would say I would give it a B minus because I like the topic. I'm intrigued by the notions. But as a movie, I sat there going, well, I'm only watching this because I'm sort of interested, not because it's compelling. Yeah. I loved Shakespeare in Love, and that could be a whole other podcast about how I agree when it won Best Picture and Saving Private Ryan isn't as good as everybody else, but that's a separate podcast. I thought, you know, I'd give it a B minus.
I'd give it a 73. I liked the lyrics, but I couldn't really dance to it.
Thank you, Simon Cowell.
I was referencing Dick Clark, but
I'm trying to hip you up.
I'm just old. What can I say? I mean, I don't think it's an entertaining movie for people who don't actually have some concept of what this nonsense is all about.
I agree.
So I think it plays to a narrow audience.
Yes.
I have to say, I expected it to be enormously entertaining for the wrong reasons, and it fully met my expectations.
Everything you expected and less.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm going to say B-ish.
B-ish?
B-ish.
Had a B-like quality?
A B-like quality. I love the costuming.
Yeah.
And I could just...
It was handsome. Yeah.
It was... Everything was really pretty. The matte paintings were really well done. It was a nice one to watch.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed Queen Elizabeth's performance.
Which one?
Vanessa Redgrave.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
It was kind of delightfully over the top. Not unlike when we saw her in Long Day's Journey into Night.
Yes, where OTT doesn't even begin to capture it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I will say, and Jolie Richardson is lovely, lovely as the younger Queen Elizabeth.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, just to give credit where it's due. And I liked the guy who played Ben Johnson. I thought he was very good for most of the movie. I thought it was Dominic Cooper, and then I saw the credits and found out I was wrong.
Right.
But I thought it was one of Dominic Cooper's best performances.
Well, and I loved Christopher Guest as the evil
Robert Cecil. I'm not sure that was Count Rugen.
That wasn't Christopher Guest?
No.
Well, it was an uncanny impression.
It wasn't that.
It looked a lot like him.
It did look like an awful lot like him.
Six fingers? Yeah. Were there six fingers on his right hand?
So we have to go back and see the movie again now.
Yeah.
I
get Matt Rippey's grade?
Oh, yeah. What's your grade?
Oh, I give it, just based on the facial hair alone, I give it an A+.
There you go.
I could watch that all day long.
Well, and I liked David Thewlis as the older Sir Cecil. William Cecil.
I'm a big fan. As opposed to Beanie and Cecil.
That's right. He was their descendant.
I am confused, though. When our first introduction to David Thewlis, he was decaying on screen. They had aged him so much, and I'm not sure they went with a younger and an older actress for Queen Elizabeth.
Oh, yeah.
And because of the age gap and the kind of aging that happens at that point in life, I don't know why they didn't go with two different actors.
Well, it's completely inconsistent on the age thing because Ben Johnson doesn't age a day in the film.
That's right.
You know, Shakespeare, nothing. We watch a lot of the other characters. We have some of the characters played by different actors, younger and older, and then there are just some of the people. So the jumps in time in the film get completely bewildering because whether it's facial hair or whatever, some of the people obviously got attention for that, and some of the people just didn't rate hair and makeup.
Well, and the critical consensus is not good for this film.
Throughout the country.
I mean, I've looked at New York Times. A.O. Scott was surprisingly, he said a very funny first paragraph, and I'm going to paraphrase, but it was something like, this is an affront to literary, this is an outrage, and blah, blah, blah. But given all that, it's not bad. You know, Bob Mondello, who I was hoping could join us today at NPR, said, you know, some people will be sitting there in the audience going, where did this all come from? A source, my kingdom for a source.
Nice. Well, what's your grade, though? Have you graded it? What do you give it?
I gave it a B minus.
Right.
Because I'm more interested. But I think you guys, Howard and Reed, are right. It's a limited audience. If you didn't care about the topic, why would you go see it? And even kind of if you do, how do you keep with it? It didn't feel like it's gripping.
Yeah.
To me,
if you care about the topic, then stay away. If you like, you know, fancy costume dramas with people with cool accents, then definitely.
Yeah, go for it.
And facial hair.
I love the fact that the film reached out to teachers across the country, and we are in possession. It took quite some time, but through our sources, we were able to obtain the study guide distributed to teachers. And so when we refer to Mr. Mondello and My Kingdom for a Source, here's the number one resource in a list in the study guide, the anonymous movie website.
Oh, well, all right. At least they've researched it.
The number two resource, the website of the people who wrote the study guide.
Right.
I think this tells us what we need to know, and I know we're being very facetious. I'm not making that up.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, and here's my... Last night, in advance of the movie, I went to some... The internet, you know, you can find stuff on there.
Yeah.
And
I've heard of such a thing.
Researching arguments. You can get it on a computer now. trying to find out arguments for De Vere.
Yeah.
And about 90% of the arguments for De Vere are not arguments for De Vere. It's just that there's very little evidence, hard evidence, that Shakespeare wrote the plays, which is different from proving that Edward De Vere. I mean, does anybody here?
Well,
believe
I interviewed Jonathan Bond, who for a podcast interview a year and a half ago when I was here in New York, in fact, and he has written a book called The De Vere Code, which proves in his mind that in his discoveries that De Vere wrote the sonnets. He makes no case for the plays, and I know that Derek Jacobi, for instance, and Mark Rylance, two well-known Shakespearean actors who are both also in the movie. I don't know if they're Oxfordians, but I believe they're at least anti-Stratfordians, which means that they do not believe that William Shakespeare wrote
the play. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where that puts them on the Oxford scale.
Two of the arguments I just don't buy is, well, he wasn't educated. Yeah. He didn't travel. You can't explain genius.
Yeah.
Just because you're educated, there were many people who were educated, that doesn't mean you could write that play.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the logic of that argument would suggest that everybody who was educated could write Shakespeare's plays.
Right. It's called imagination and genius, and, yeah. and you can't justify it. And in the movie, they sort of, about a third or a quarter of Shakespeare's plays came out after De Vere was dead. So at the little end, they have this little coda where he's giving Ben Jonson these plays to distribute over the next several years.
And also, in the midst of the movie, there's this huge shelf of manuscripts where clearly he's written every single one of the plays. They're just sitting there.
Yeah.
Waiting to be, and apparently, according to the movie, he wrote Midsummer Night's Dream.
As a teenager.
As a 10 or 12 year old.
Yeah, which is a fascinating theory. Is that and many of the plays may have been written, you know, as a child, and suddenly they're just being rediscovered.
Yeah.
So, you know, the question is, was Shakespeare or De Vere or whomever Mozart?
Right.
And perhaps this was Amadeus.
I preferred that film.
Yes,
that explains the laugh. One of the other playwrights that.
Yeah, that's true.
That was a tie to Amadeus.
That was a homage to Amadeus. Well spotted, Allie. Well spotted. Well, and getting back to this study guide that you unearthed, that Sony Pictures
choked on those words.
Yeah, that Sony has put out. I mean, I that's where I think people are getting most upset is that. But as you say, Matt Rippey, it's phenomenal marketing.
Yep.
Phenomenal marketing, just to get let's get people talking about the theory. It's a little bit like birtherism, or you know, or evolution, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a little like all of that, and so in a sense, I can see why some Shakespeareans are upset. It's like, oh, we've got to waste time debunking the argument anymore. I love the reaction of Gail Pastor, who's the former head of the Folger Shakespeare Library, who's now a CBE, a commander of the British Empire. When I asked her on the podcast what she thought of the authorship question, she said, oh, there is no question. That seems like the right response, you know, like not an overreaction.
Yeah, but, you know, I admire that point of view, but I think it's great fun to do this.
Yeah.
I mean, because, well, look what we're doing here right now.
Yeah.
It's great fun to do this. And, you know, just to flip it around, it is highly unlikely that an uneducated person without lots of money would have access to so much information. So that's a little tiny chink in the armor of the argument, but... But then again, you know, it's fascinating to consider conspiracy theories. And let's face it, there have been great conspiracies that took place with thousands of people in on it. I mean, for instance, we managed to create the bomb just towards the end of the World War II with tens of thousands of people were involved in that. And guess what? It was kept a secret. Even the vice president didn't know where it was and how far along it was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are conspiracies out there.
For 2 years.
Yeah,
but let's also
when it mattered the most.
Yeah. Let's also remember how many people Steve Austin told he was bionic over the years, and yet no one ever really seemed to get out there that he was in fact the $6 million man.
And nature abhors a vacuum, and there isn't incontrovertible proof that Shakespeare wrote the plays. And so, you know, people are rising up. I think people cling to conspiracy theories the way some people cling to religion. Myself, I'm agnostic. I can't wait to find out, and until then, it's all fun.
Since Matt has brought us down by bringing up the atomic bomb in the conversation, I'm actually going to take just a moment to be quasi-serious and say, this film is fine. See it if you want to see it. Don't see it if you don't want to see it. But the only thing that is remotely problematic about this film is if it is the only exposure young people get to Shakespeare or the story of Shakespeare. Because unfortunately, in our society, people do sometimes believe everything they read or see. And this is, as the film declares, and I'm going to hold this like a flag that I champion, this is a work
of fiction. And as long as nobody believes it, then fine. The fact is stories of who Shakespeare was, and we've mentioned Shakespeare in Love, there's a lot of them. There's a great play, recent play by a playwright named Bill Kane called Equivocation, which is wonderful and about how Shakespeare came to write his plays and what he based them on. You could go back to Edward Bond's Bingo. Bill Gibson, who wrote The Miracle Worker, wrote a play called A Cry of Players, which was done back in the 60s. I think there are countless versions of the story of who Shakespeare was. And you know what? If one of Shakespeare's achievements was to leave enough room for other artists to create works about who he was, that's actually even cooler, and I'm blowing my own mind as I say.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your outrageous authorship theories via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on our website podcast page, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. There you can post your reviews of Anonymous. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, upstart crow Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Sandy Daniel. No reason, it's just random. Thanks to Kimberly Cox, also known as A Gidget Widget on Twitter, for joining our reduced tweet-up today and for bringing the fantastic cupcakes. Special thanks to arts pundit theater blogger Howard Sherman. Follow him on Twitter @HESherman. And special thanks to Mike Whitmore, the director of the Folger Shakespeare Library, who I think, like us, will not be changing the name of his institution anytime soon. And thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 256 768ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
I think you're right that this should not be the only film about Shakespeare that they see. It should not be the only work regarding Shakespeare. I think the other thing that they should go see is the complete works of William Shakespeare by the Reduced Shakespeare Company. And then that's all you need.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less.